You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the latest Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 5th to the 11th of September 2013. My name is Chris Parr. I'm joined today by books editor Karen Shook, deputy news editor John Morgan, reporter David Matthews and editor John Gill. More than half of UK HE institutions use 0 hours contracts. We'll hear just how many university staff are on the controversial deals. The so-called Old Boys Network has long been blamed for giving graduates from certain institutions a leg up in the labour market. Some new research has shown just how important those informal networks are. This week's book of the week is Arlie Russell Hochschild's essay collection entitled So How's the Family? Karen will tell us a bit more about that and the rest of our book section. And this week's cover feature looks at academics who have changed their area of specialism, heading down alternative career paths. A little later, we'll also hear from THE Rankings editor Phil Beatty, who will explain a little bit more about the Alma Mater Index, which shows the link between a university's reputation and its graduate success in business. But before all that, John Morgan, 0 hours contract, or 0 hours contracts, I should say, have been making headlines of late. Their prevalence in higher education is now a little bit clearer.
That's right. So this is a survey by the University and College Union of universities' use of 0 hours contracts. Obviously, 0 hours contracts have been extremely controversial because they don't offer staff any certainty over the hours they will work and thus any certainty on their income. So basically, the UCU found that of 142 institutions that responded, 75 said they used 0 hours contracts for teaching, research and or academic related staff. And that adds up to over 24,000 academic staff on 0 hours contracts at these 71 institutions that supplied data. Interestingly, Edinburgh, which had the highest number of staff on 0 hours contracts, according to the UCU's figures, has now said that it's going to cease all use of 0 hours contracts by the end of the calendar year. Mm.
So hopefully, I guess that's a leading by example, an example that others will follow.
Yeah, it's seems quite a clear and surprising course of action by Edinburgh, and I think it's in response to some data gathering that's been going on at local level in talks with the local union rather than this survey that the UCU's carried out. And I mean, the UCU says the reason why universities are using 0 hours contracts is to avoid things like enhanced sick and maternity pay that come with your fixed term permanent contracts. But then two of the universities that figured quite highly in the figures said that actually they offer equal entitlements to those on 0 hours contracts, including access to the pension scheme. So there's differences of opinion as to why universities are doing it. But it does seem like Edinburgh are very clear that they'll be phasing it out.
I think that putting aside the rights and wrongs of whether it's appropriate to have staff on these sorts of contracts, universities and perhaps Edinburgh, in making this decision, are responding to the fact that it's a real toxic term now, isn't it? 0 hours, after all the coverage that it had in the national press in the summer, and you can just imagine the headlines that this data might potentially lead to if you've got students who are paying higher fees than ever before coming into university expecting, they've been told by everybody from David Willetts down, that they're going to be getting the best student experience there's ever been for their extra fees that they're paying. And now we've got figures suggesting that they'll be coming in and a significant number of the people who are teaching them will be on 0 hours contracts, and so might be worrying about how many hours they'll get next week, how they're going to pay the bills, rather than the job in hand, which of course is providing a really first class education to those people. So even if the reality of life as a 0 hours lecturer isn't as bad as it might be being a 0 hours person who works in the local branch of Burger King, I think there's a perception problem for universities here, and probably Edinburgh's quick and quite firm response that they'll be phasing out the use of 0 hours contracts probably is a bit of sort of reputation management as much as anything. I don't know if that chimes with you, John, and the people you've spoken to.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, obviously Edinburgh's a prestigious institution. I'm sure it doesn't want to be associated with any perception of slightly less than prestigious employment practices. The employers would say and have said that 0 hours contracts are very useful for students who carry out casual work and for you know, highly skilled professionals in areas like law who have a main employment in their industry and just do some lecturing on the side. So I'm sure it's not as...
And of course there has been a very long tradition of postgraduate students doing a bit of teaching on the side, and they wouldn't necessarily expect to have long full-time contracts, would they? So this isn't necessarily a new thing, but I think there's certainly such scrutiny of 0 hours and such interest in it that it's bad news for universities that there are quite so many people working on these contracts.
Yeah, but perhaps good news, those figures are coming to light, and then we can have a proper discussion about what it means. A second, slightly more light-hearted article by John Morgan this week contains some first-rate marketing speak presented to one English university. Make sure you read this week's magazine to find out who's developing a Challenger Lighthouse identity. Quite an intriguing phrase. But David, moving on to you, you've got a story this week on old boys networks. Maybe that's a slightly old-fashioned term these days, but I think everyone knows what it refers to. Some new research into their role in graduates' careers. Which institutions are we talking about here?
Well, this is a piece of research that interviewed a number of students at inverted commas, elite institutions, so University of Oxford in the UK and Sciences Po in Paris, a very prestigious institution there, one of the grand écoles, and often seen as sort of training ground for civil service. And you know, this term, old boys network, you know, people getting jobs through connections rather than through sort of more formal, rigorous means. You know, it's been around for a while. Often comes up, in relation to Oxbridge. But from this research, these interviews with these students, it does appear very much sort of alive and well. You know, the students, regularly use kind of informal networks and connections to get their jobs, you know, ones that weren't formally advertised. And there's a, you know, in a variety of ways. So I think one of the most striking things was that at both universities, these kind of, very sort of prestigious employers, law firms, consultancies, financial institutions, really targeted, like, you know, just a couple of universities at the sort of the top of the tree, as it were, you know, took students out to dinners, you know, emailed them, kind of really schmoozed them. And I suppose you can understand, you know, employers wanting to go to universities where there are the highest entrance qualifications. But what the point this paper makes is that, you know, it's not as though, you know, the sort of magic circle law firms are targeting Oxbridge and then, you know, having a slightly lesser effort on, you know, other Russell Group institutions. It's basically all concentrated in a few universities. So if you've got very slightly lower grades at A level, it means you basically won't have a shot at all at any of these firms, which means it's a really sort of skewed and actually not particularly meritocratic system.
And if the student intake to those institutions is as skewed as it sometimes can appear from, you know, certain types of school and so on, then that just... I mean, in America, we ran a piece recently, a feature on a book, I think, that was looking specifically at the issue of sororities and fraternities at the sort of most expensive private universities and colleges in America as well, making a very similar point that you have this system where it's all kind of word of mouth and who you know rather than... So actually, when you go to, you know, University X in California or wherever, and pay fees of, you know, $30,000-$40,000 a year, in a way you're buying access to those networks as much as the education. So that's the slippery slope that you start to head down with that, isn't it?
Exactly. And you might expect, okay, so once you're into one of these universities, you're set. But actually, even within these networks, there's a kind of filtering system. So from the interviews with the students, the you know, the firms are kind of looking for, as they put it, you know, students with the right social and cultural fit. Now, what exactly does that mean? And
I think we can guess.
Well, yes, exactly. So you're basically excluding those who aren't really like you, even if they do happen to go to
Oxford. Even if they accidentally got to Oxford.
Well, exactly.
The story quotes an Oxford student from a lower middle class background who found that even with access to those sorts of old boys networks, unless you have the funding to be able to work for nothing for a long time, you might as well give it up. So you've passed all those hurdles only to discover that there's a VIP room beyond the VIP room you're in.
This was a very similar theme from the book I mentioned earlier. I think there was a case, wasn't there, of one of the researchers who actually went back to this unnamed university and started to do the research there into the social networks and the social and cultural capital that you needed to sort of get on in these places in the sorority, saying that, you know, even going back as a 30-something researcher, she suddenly found herself with all the sort of insecurities of someone coming from a slightly lower social background that she had, you know, when she'd gone through university as an undergraduate, and kind of realising what a sort of shark tank it can be is, well, it's interesting, but slightly depressing.
Slightly depressing and still going on, it seems. Moving swiftly on, Karen, our books section this week, what's in store for readers?
Well, we never have any shortage of eminent scholars whose books we're covering in the section. I think this week our Book of the Week author is probably one of the most important sociologists still working, still alive. Her name is Arlie Russell Hochschild. She is an emeritus professor at the University of California, Berkeley, and so many of the terms we associate with the modern working world, with gender relations, were invented by her. Emotional labor, she did key work in that field. Terms like the outsourced self, the time bind, the second shift, the managed heart, these are all areas where she has not only done groundbreaking work, but she came up with the terms. This week, Stina Lyon at London South Bank University is reviewing a collection of essays by Arlie Russell Hochschild, So How's the Family? It centers on that kind of outsourced work that is given, particularly caring, as in caring for children, and giving birth to other people's children. Basically, the first world hiring people from the third world to look after their children, of course, then that causes a knock-on effect of who's looking after their children at home and what the value is placed on these pieces. It's an extremely important collection of essays. And she has said that really her main focus now is the impact of the market on so much else in life. So we're used to seeing that in terms of the impact on higher education, but her work is central to looking at how we are all neoliberals now, as has been said by others. So it's a good way into her work if you haven't read it. Another interesting review this week. We don't often have anonymous reviews, unlike, say, the TLS in the old days where all reviews were anonymous. That practice ended there some years ago. But in certain situations, we do have anonymous reviewers here. I was approached by an academic who was interested in reviewing the book, but she didn't feel it appropriate to use her name. It's called Cheating Lessons. Learning from academic dishonesty.
Can you say why this person wasn't keen?
Because in her review, she wanted to talk about some things that she had observed at her university that she found very troubling in terms of cheating and collusion that went on between students. Not only that, not only the prevalence of this practice, but also her feeling and her experience that her superiors did not want to know about it, emphasized how difficult it was to prove. She and her fellow academics had the experience of knowing just how difficult it would be to say that students had colluded, that they had stolen things. She recalls getting quite stern emails from parents of students, the parents happening to be barristers, and talking about their concerns in a way that, you know, led the academic to believe that they might be biting off more than they could chew if they attempted to discuss it. Just a disheartening feeling that it's very difficult to pursue these, and that her superiors really do not have any interest in stirring up a hornet's nest. Now, this book, Cheating Lessons, she describes as being a bit too much Dead Poets Society and a bit too much, well, maybe the students are cheating because we're demanding too much of them. And the author also talks about the Catholic ethos of his institution, where I guess the kind of Dead Poets Society love in means that people don't feel they have to cheat. Our reviewer thinks that's nonsense.
It's a fascinating topic. And also, just thinking back to one of the earlier items, if, you know, full-time lecturer or professor, as in this case, feels it's difficult to sort of challenge students on this point and doesn't have the backing of their superiors, how much harder would it be if you were a 0 hours lecturer who kind of was just, you know, hoping for a few more hours next week? I mean, it's one of those things that just shows you the further difficulties that you'll get into if you start to give people less firm foundations in their jobs, I think.
Absolutely. And this is a story I have heard from so many of my contributors. They all have examples of plagiarism, of suspect practices by students, and the feeling either by these academics that they want a quiet life, or the sense that if they tried to uncover the nature of the plagiarism, they would not be thanked for it. The reliance by their institutions on Turnitin, which is the software that universities use. Turnitin's been very successful at selling this software to institutions. But of course, it doesn't identify custom written essays as our anonymous opinions piece writer who worked at an essay mill said. If you pay someone to write something from scratch, obviously Turnitin is not going to identify it. I get the sense, just from the people I speak to among my reviewers, that they're extremely disheartened that it may not be 100% of their students, but where it does happen, the academics feel that they are having to abandon their principles in order to follow what's expected of them.
Mm. No, that piece is still online as well, the Essay Mill anonymous writer. Very interesting it was too. Really does blow open how easy it is to get round some of the systems in place to catch cheats.
A couple of hundred quid,
yeah. Moving on slightly to our cover feature. Now, how many of you have considered a complete change of direction? Why research grass on this side of the road when it's so much greener on the other? John, our cover feature looks at researchers who have changed direction. You commissioned it. What's it all about?
Yeah, it was... it's interesting, this, because our cover feature is written by Professor Dame Nancy Rothwell, who, of course, is... one of the most eminent scientists in the land, and also Vice Chancellor of the University of Manchester, and she started out as a young scientist studying in the field of metabolism and physiology. And you mentioned there, Chris. You know, do you sometimes think grass is greener? It wasn't the case in her instance, as she sort of spotted some field of research that she thought looked more interesting or more lucrative, or you know, richer pickings from a scientific point of view. But rather, in the course of an experiment, she made a very dramatic discovery, which was quite unexpected, quite out of the blue, as so often with great scientific discoveries. And that really was a turning point for her, where she had a fork in the road and had to decide whether to carry on with studying metabolism and physiology, as she had very successfully, or to take this sort of door that had unexpectedly opened to her and throw her lot into a new world of stroke and neuroscience. And she chose to do that very bravely. And of course, it's, as she says in the piece, it's not quite as dramatic as moving from physics to biology, but it was suddenly she was in a field where she went from being a real expert to having almost no expertise at all. And she says she had to sort of catch up on the literature that she hadn't read. And even today, she says she feels that there are gaps in her knowledge. She went from being, you know, talking as the keynote speaker at international academic conferences, to being a guest at the back who kind of no one who knew who she was and was perhaps particularly interested in her opinion. So she had this incredibly exciting but probably terrifying moment in her academic life where she was flung into something completely new. And she said it was scary and it was terrifying, and she went into it with a certain amount of naivety perhaps, but actually it was brilliant as well, because she came into a field with no preconceptions, completely free mind. And I think that allowed her to make connections and discover new things that perhaps she wouldn't have done if she had come through a more traditional route. And Nancy talks very interestingly about the way that perhaps it would be even more difficult to do what she did today because of the way that research is funded and the way that career structures are set up. But actually, she thinks that's a real mistake because of the nature of science and the nature of discoveries and the way that doors can open to you that you perhaps wouldn't have foreseen. And of course, she then went on to have a third change of academic life, if you like, because she went into the management side of things and became vice chancellor of one of the biggest universities in the land as well, and suddenly had to learn a whole new set of skills and pressures and problems as a vice chancellor. So it's a fascinating piece about the way that you can perhaps pursue an academic career that isn't in a straitjacket, but you know, the question of taking opportunities as they present themselves and not being scared of trying new things.
I mean, I suppose, speaking from personal experience, for all of us here, this is something journalists do all the time. So you remain a journalist, but you might go and cover several different areas of the world. And, you know, on the one hand, that, you know, probably gives you a greater breadth of what you're able to cover. You know a bit more about how the world works. But then, do you end up with the same expertise at the end of your career? But of course, it's a lot easier for a journalist to do this than I imagine an academic would be. Because yeah. you really are starting almost from the back of the queue as an academic. Whereas
absolutely, yeah. I mean, there's a whole lot more sort of foundation building that goes into academic careers probably than journalistic careers. But I think one of the things that I found really interesting was the way that she said that actually coming in with a perspective that's fresh and unencumbered by some of the stuff that building that foundation brings with it gave her opportunities that perhaps some of her peers didn't have. And people often say that, you know, academics make that do their best work before the age of 30. It's in that first phase of their career when they're looking at things as perhaps, you know, with fresh eyes that they make the big discoveries and the big breakthroughs. And perhaps what she did gave her an opportunity to have more than
to
one
start again,
early
rewind.
Phase. So even between the ages of 30 and 40, I don't know what age she was when she made this change, but she had that early phase again and she was able to come in with a perspective that perhaps some other people in the field didn't have. So it's a really, really interesting. I mean, of course, not everyone is going to be Dame Nancy Rothwell and have the drive and energy to do that. But I think it's definitely interesting to look at different career paths and the ways that people do things.
Absolutely. You had a change yourself this week, John, of course, a hot topic of discussion in the office, and a few tweets as well. Your new profile picture that appears next to your editorial.
The byline picture, yeah.
Causing quite
it,
yeah. a stir. Why the new image?
honestly, it's... Well, my old picture was just a point-and-shoot job in the office, and we had a very good snapper, actually, Peter Searle, coming in to take some photos of Phil Beatty, because he's often up on advertising hoarding sort of 30 feet high photographs of him in China when he goes to talk about ranking. So I had a couple of shots done as well. But everyone's enjoyed taking the piss out of me. So thanks for that.
Yeah, no, very, very dashing it is too. Speaking of Phil, you will all have noticed that your THE came with an additional magazine this week, a supplement on our alma mater index. I spoke with Phil, our rankings editor, a little bit earlier just to find out what that's all about.
Well, this is a very straightforward exercise, actually, but I think it's really interesting, really good fun. We've just literally looked at the universities which have produced or nurtured the world's leading executives. So we've taken the Fortune Global 500 list and we've simply looked at the biographies of all the chief executives and found out which universities they've got degrees from. So it's a really interesting but very simple ranking.
And what does it? What are the big findings? As ever with rankings, who comes out on top? And if you want to be a global chief exec, where do you want to go to university?
I mean, I think we have to acknowledge the limitations to this extent that, you know, there are many factors that makes a successful executive, and I'm sure there'll be a few who are leading the world's best companies, and they attribute to it to their mother or to their business's experiences in the real world, and they won't all attribute to it to university, and there'll be people who dropped out of university, didn't go to university. So we have to acknowledge that university is not the full picture. But I think it is very interesting that you do get some clear patterns. Very, very unsurprisingly, top of all these sorts of tables, we do have Harvard University at number one. They've sort of issued degrees to 31 of the current top 500 CEOs. Mm-hmm. But outside that kind of rather unimaginative top spot, it's a really interesting list because of its diversity. There's 17 countries in the top 100. The US dominates as usual, but China has the next most, and then Japan. And a lot of it's the demographics of these top companies, you know, but we are seeing some interesting institutions that don't get recognition in traditional rankings really showing up in this list. So you've got Harvard first, Tokyo second, Stanford third. But actually after that, you get some really interesting institutions like HEC Paris, which isn't in the world rankings at all because it's too small and specialist. The Grand Ecole of France do exceptionally well. You've got INSEAD.
France has got Polytechnique. Three institutions in the top 10, France. They don't typically have those sort of numbers in the Times Higher University rankings, do they?
Yeah, I mean, this is an interesting one, actually, because I think what it does suggest potentially is that France has an exceptionally elite system. The Grand Ecole don't do well in traditional rankings because they're quite small, they're quite selective, they don't have a huge research output. But what they do, I think, and it's a controversial element, is they cream off the absolute elite of the French school system, and they are elite institutions. So in some respects in France, it might be more exposing the narrowness of their education system that a small group of small Grand Ecole cream off the best, and they end up in all the best executive jobs. It's a possibly negative issue for the French to discuss, but I think for other institutions it is something to celebrate. The UK's Oxford and Cambridge fall quite low down this list, but the only other UK university on the list is City University, which is nowhere in the world top 400 of the traditional rankings, but because of a few CEOs making the top through their business school, it's finding itself on the list. So it's a nice, fun list, recognising some different institutions. But particularly for me, it's, in a simple way, it is capturing one of the things that rankings don't capture, and it's that crucial element, essential to students and essential to universities, your role as a university in nurturing future talent and producing the future world leaders and creating the thinkers and the visionaries that become top of the pack, in this case in business. But I think we should also acknowledge, you know, we'd like to look at culture in the arts and maybe public service as well as a way of capturing this extra element that's not very well captured in traditional rankings.
Yeah, it's a fascinating supplement. You'll get that online. It's also distributed in every issue of this week's Times Higher Education, so make sure you check it out. And thanks for talking to me, Phil.
Thank you very much.
So there we have it, the latest Times Higher Education issue review podcast. If you want to talk about anything we've discussed on the show or indeed in the magazine elsewhere, you can do so at timeshighereducation.co.uk. You'll also find links on there to our rankings pages and all that Alma Mater Index stuff. You can find us on Twitter, on Facebook, on Google+, on LinkedIn, all the places you'd expect to. Just search for Times Higher Ed. But that's the end of this week's issue review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.